Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry. For almost all of my life, Roe versus Wade was the law of the land. While states continued to attack the rights of pregnant people to our bodies, we had that basic fact to give us some refuge. That is now gone, thanks to an extremist Supreme Court. To discuss where we are and where we might go, we've invited Ricky Solinger and Crystal Littlejohn, co-editors of the new anthology Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade, onto the show.
There is a group of women now suing the state of Texas over its near-complete abortion ban. Among them, one who developed life-threatening sepsis and spent days in the ICU after being told by hospital doctors that although her baby had no chance of survival, she was not sick enough to have an abortion.
When we're talking about access to contraception, when we're talking about access to abortions, we're having discussions on a binary spectrum. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of bodies who get pregnant, all sorts of bodies who need access to that level of care.
It's really difficult for people to access care. You mentioned about 18 states that now have some kind of abortion ban in place. So people are still seeking care, but they're having to go hundreds, if not thousands of miles to get that care.
No twists, no turns. It went nearly straight down party lines.
The motion is not agreed to.
The Senate blocked debate on a measure writing some federal abortion rights into law with all Republicans.
Their extreme proposal goes way, way beyond codifying the status quo.
And West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin opposing.
Hi, I'm Crystal Littlejohn, and I'm fighting for reproductive justice.
I'm Ricky Solinger. I've spent my whole adult life as a historian and curator fighting for, protecting, and trying to resurrect reproductive rights and justice. Sorry, not sorry.
Thank you so much, Ricky and Crystal, for being a part of the podcast. Welcome to Sorry, Not Sorry. Can you just maybe start by telling our listeners a bit about who you are and the work that you do? Maybe, Ricky, you want to go first?
Okay. I am a historian. I've been writing books about reproductive politics in the United States with questions about the racialization of the population at their heart. And sometimes it feels like I've been writing the same book for the last 137 years, just from slightly different perspectives. And I'm a devoted reproductive rights and justice activist, always wanting to think that books are organizing tools, books are forms of activism.
And Crystal?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm Crystal Littlejohn. I'm an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. And in my work, I use research on people's lived experiences to fight for reproductive justice. I'm also the author of Just Get on the Pill, The Uneven Burden of Reproductive Politics. And alongside my dear friend and colleague, Ricky Solinger, I'm a co-editor of our book, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade, where we showcase the committed and courageous folks that are fighting for abortion across domains.
I think it's very appropriate that we're recording this episode on International Women's Day. And I think my first real question that I want to ask is, how are women and other people who could become pregnant faring in the United States from your point of view right now at this moment in history?
I'll start. I think that question doesn't have a universal answer. It depends on where you sit and the resources that your community possesses and can provide. I think as we see in the news, women are being turned away from reproductive health care that they desperately need. I think those people are faring badly. I think people who are contemplating IVF don't know what they're facing. One certainly needs to say that nothing could make Republicans support abortion like IVF, which has abortion at its very core. And it's a service that is accessed by people who are 91% white. So that's an interesting feature of Republican support for abortion, newly conceived. I think it's very complicated because the country is split. Nearly half the states have some kind of limited or criminalizing laws. People living in those states are definitely suffering from a variety of directions, including, in many cases, forced pregnancy, state forced pregnancy. On the other hand, in the states that Crystal and I live in, and what was the Union during the Civil War, women are doing much better. It's complicated in some cases for people to think about these issues at all because they still have Roe-like rights.
But I do want to clarify, because you said the country is split, and what I don't want my listeners to think is that they're morally split on this issue, because legally, and they're legally split, but there is a huge majority of this country that believes that every woman should have access to a safe and legal abortion. Huge majority. I think that number's upwards of 90%. Is that right, Ben? You're my numbers guy.
Yeah, I think it depends on how you ask the question. But in any case, the answer is pretty substantial. I've seen answers anywhere from like mid-60s to mid-90s, depending on who you ask and how you ask it. But in any case, it's a pretty substantial majority of people who do this. And Ricky, I think that you mentioned something, and you started talking about this, that I think is really important as I'm reading the book. And in the introduction, you talk about the unequal injustice that comes with the Dobbs decision. And I don't think that inequality gets discussed enough as we're talking about abortion, because it does not. And I think this book is the definitive proof of this, that the Dobbs decision does not impact people equally. And I wonder if, Crystal and Ricky, you would like to just start talking a little bit about some of those inequalities that the book explores.
Absolutely. And so I think building on what Ricky was talking about, many people who can get pregnant are struggling, and they've been struggling for a very long time. Obviously, they're struggling to get the abortion care that they need and deserve.
This is the case of Kate Cox. She is the woman in Texas who had a pregnancy that was almost certain. In nearly every case, the fetus does not survive, and beyond that, puts her health at risk. She was first granted, allowed to have the abortion, then that got stayed. There was an urgency, obviously, to getting this done, but there was no ruling. So what we just learned is that after weeks of what her lawyers say are legal whiplash that have been hellish for her, she has decided to go out of state. That offers have been coming in from Kansas to Colorado to Canada.
They're also struggling to get the appropriate standard of maternal care that they deserve, that they have a right to. They're also struggling to be able to afford childcare for their children. And I think that's where reproductive justice as a framework and movement is so important in helping us understand the ways that inequalities can disproportionately affect women and people who get pregnant from marginalized backgrounds. And the ways that as we're focusing on abortion and fighting for abortion access, that we're also being mindful of people's right to a full spectrum of reproductive experiences. They have a right to have an abortion when they want and need an abortion. They have a right to have children when they want to have children. They have a right to have access to birth control when they want to have access to birth control and to contraception specifically. But we know that being a Black woman in the United States, being disabled in the United States, all of these different axes of oppression negatively affect people's right to live the lives that they want to live and to have access to healthcare and reproductive healthcare that they deserve when they need it. And I think as a framework and movement, reproductive justice really helps us show the way toward liberation for people by specifically focusing on the ways that inequalities differentially impact their lives and specifically negatively impact their lives.
We'll be right back.
I wonder if you feel that there is a disconnect with how we talk about this issue within the movement, right? Within the group of people who fight for reproductive justice every single day as part of their being, and people who are not traveling in our spaces. I often wonder if we, like even just the phrase reproductive justice or environmental justice, I'm wondering if we're alienating a whole group of people because they just can't grasp what that even means because they're just trying to get food on the table.
I think actually reproductive justice is a great step forward from choice, the word that's so defined, because so many people in the United States know that they really don't have choices, and it all depends on their individual access to resources. You know, one of the big changes, not only in the domain of reproductive politics, but in many domains, but very specifically here, that when I first started working in this area, people talked about women, and they talked about motherhood, and they talked about pregnancy as if it were the same for everybody, and as if my experience as a white middle-class woman would be the same as anybody else's. And one of the things that reproductive justice asks that is done and that proponents do is to put people who have been marginalized by laws and policies and racism and white supremacy, to put their stories in the center. Because if we don't do that, we are really actually reproducing white racism on the page or in the interview or wherever we find ourselves talking about these matters.
Obviously, totally agree with that. I'm just wondering, just from perception, let's just say the woman who's in Dubuque, Iowa, who can't see past just trying to make ends meet, call it choice. Trust me, I understand the racial, the systemic white supremacy, patriarchal, all of it, and why it should be called reproductive justice. But I'm wondering if we do a good enough job explaining how reproductive justice affects everybody.
I'm just going to make one more stab, and then I'm going to turn it over to my pal. That changing paradigms and changing language is a long process. I think reproductive justice has penetrated. I think it's penetrated remarkably in many domains that I previously could never get people off the choice dime. They are now off it. I'm not talking about people in the city. I'm talking about people across the country. But nevertheless, there is a period of transition, and I'm sure you're right that there's some people who haven't been reached by this yet. But that doesn't mean that they're unreachable, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
But if those are the people going to the polls, how do we bridge the wording divide? Because obviously there's no perfect language. Ben and I talk about this all the time. What a word means to one person, it means something totally different depending on so many things. But I just worry that by not giving the full story and by being so nitpicky about the way in which we title a movement.
Look at the referenda. This wasn't a problem with referenda. People went out. They voted. We're talking about voting rights. We're talking about abortion rights. That's fine. Nobody's trying to slather reproductive justice over the concept of abortion rights. Truly, in reproductive justice framework, abortion rights are very important and essential, but they're not the only thing that matters.
We are starting today with some women's issues, actually, that have been thrust into the political spotlight. So after Roe v. Wade was struck down a year and a half ago, some of these issues have come up. For instance, Alabama. State legislators are hoping to pass a bill that would give immunity to IVF clinics and patients after the state Supreme Court ruled that frozen embryos are children. The governor of Alabama said she anticipates a bill on her desk shortly. So they're trying to control some damage there. Hundreds of families are now expected to rally today at the state capitol in support of IVF and to pressure lawmakers to act.
It also matters that you can feed your children if you're going to decide to have them, that you do have a roof over your head. These are things that people understand, but nobody who's out there doing political work is saying, I want you to listen to reproductive justice. And if you don't listen to it, well, screw you. We're talking about abortion rights in Ohio, in Kentucky, in Kansas.
I'm just going to hop in here for a second and put my rhetorician hat on, because I think that what we're seeing here actually is kind of embodied in the book. When we talk rhetoric, the way that you speak is dependent on your audience, right? So you're going to say something to one audience one way and perhaps differently to another way. And we as activists have to be better at that, I think, about changing what we say to our audiences. But this book sort of engages with that idea as we see how the intersectional nature of the Dobbs decision, and we see how these people from different backgrounds, from different places of justice and injustice, are still impacted by this decision. And they speak, I think, just reading through the book, very differently about what justice means to them. And so I wonder if, Crystal, you want to talk about that a little bit, about the people we see with these different backgrounds, and how this book can be both something that's navigating the language and experience of reproductive justice or abortion rights or just justice and freedom in general, and how might that shape our fight for reproductive justice?
Absolutely. I've so appreciated our conversation, because I believe that people don't need to know the language to know oppression. They don't need to know exactly what reproductive justice means to feel what reproductive oppression is and to experience reproductive injustice. And so even if they don't know that specifically reproductive justice is about the right to have a child, not have a child, and parent children in safe and healthy communities, I do believe that people in their bones experience reproductive justice or injustice on a regular basis. And in my experience, for example, I come from a very poor background. And I talk about this with my older sister all the time, because my older sister had a child when she was 15 years old. I had never heard of the term reproductive justice when I was an 11-year-old child, but I knew in my bones what it meant that my sister could have a child at 15, that she needed access to birth control when she decided she didn't want to have any more children, that she needed access to healthcare so that she could birth my nephew and that she could survive. And so while I do believe that we don't want to use jargon, and as an academic, well, I do believe that when we're speaking to particular audiences, we need to be very careful about using jargon. I believe that reproductive justice as a concept and frame is so powerful, and that even if people don't know exactly what it means, they have a concept of what justice and injustice mean. And while I do try and help educate people to help them understand exactly what reproductive justice means as a framework, I take heart in the fact that when people hear I'm fighting for reproductive justice, when they hear this is a reproductive injustice, they do have some sort of lived experience to tie those things to. And what you see in our book is people talking about how abortion is a part of the fight for reproductive justice. It is not the end-all be-all of people's experiences with reproductive freedom and the ability to have their families look the way they want their families to look, because it can't be the end-all be-all for people. Because, for example, I would be remiss to say, if I didn't say that as a Black woman, it would be inappropriate to argue that the only thing that is important to me or to my community would be abortion. Because to be in my community, an important thing is that we have a right to have kids, right? We have a right to make sure that people understand that our fertility is something that should be honored. And abortion is part of that fight, and it must be part of that fight. Many people that have abortions are also mothers and parents. And so abortion has to be part of that fight. And I think that's what you see in this book, people fighting for abortion access, people fighting so that people across the spectrum, across social identities, have the right to get the care that Dobbs has prevented them from receiving. But also we have essayists talking about incarcerated women who did not have the right to get an abortion, even when abortion rights were supposed to be the law of the land under Roe v. Wade. And so I think it's just such an important part of the experience to think about the ways that, based on people's background, their race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, status, they're going to have different experiences with access to abortion care and also access to the other components of health and reproductive care that they need to have their families look the way they want them to look.
Imagine two similar women who each have unwanted pregnancies. They both go to abortion clinics. One has a pregnancy that's just days before the clinic's gestational limit, and the other is just days past the limit. So one of them receives an abortion, and the other is turned away. Their different life trajectories after that might not tell you a lot on their own. But if you were to track this scenario for hundreds of women, you could gather a lot of data on what life looks like after women are denied an abortion.
Okay, so you have this idea for a book, right? Fighting Mad. It's so strong. The title's so strong. Tell us how it came to be and then how you made it happen. And what was your original vision in bringing it together? And did it evolve into something else after the initial vision? Because I know for me, I could always have a very specific idea of what I want to go in saying, but then the book gods sort of take over and wind up shaping the stories that need to be told rather than the initial intent. So why don't you go into that process a little bit for us?
I'll talk about the beginnings of this book. So I was sitting at my desk at the beginning of May 2022. This was coming. It was very clearly coming. And I looked at myself metaphorically, and I said, I can slit my throat, or I can do a book, because I know how to do books. And the publisher said, oh, great. How about you call up these 25 famous women and ask them to talk to you about how they feel about Dobbs? And I said, I'm really sorry, but I can't do that. It doesn't reflect what I think is important. What I think is important is capturing the voices, the strategies, the determination of people on the ground to, so to speak, overtake Dobbs by organizing and doing political and healthcare and fundraising activities that will facilitate this form of reproductive healthcare, no matter what the law says and no matter where you live. So the first thing I did was to call up Crystal. And I said, Crystal, would you possibly consider doing this with me? And she possibly considered it. She said yes right away. So we spent that summer, the summer of 2022, just tracking down people in so many domains. We learned about what labor strategists are saying about why abortion is a labor issue. We got people, as Crystal said, who were disability rights activists, disability justice activists, environmental justice activists, who could talk about money and abortion. Everything we felt was necessary in order to put together a picture of what was going on out there in Kansas, where people were organizing for the first referendum in the most unlikely place. What was going on in Texas, where on the one hand, there was a faculty member at TU who was figuring out how to possibly get her students information about healthcare in a state in which abortion was simply illegal. And meanwhile, there's a DA who is refusing to detain or arrest people who are violating SB 8 or then state laws. And he was getting letters from all over the country from people in similar legal offices asking him, how did you do it? What can we do? From legislators in Pennsylvania, where the legislature was so split between Democrats and Republicans that the Republicans were about to criminalize abortion in Pennsylvania, but the Democrats prevailed and it stayed, and you know what that fight was like. So there's so many different ways that Dobbs has been assaulted by people in every region of the country, in Oklahoma and Louisiana and all over. We just spent hours and hours finding the right people.
And as Ricky said, I said yes as soon as she asked me because I felt compelled to create Fighting Mad. We knew the Dobbs decision was coming down from my research on young women's experiences with contraception and abortion. I knew that abortion affected every aspect of their lives. And so when it came time to put this book together, I knew that we needed to have a book that focused on abortion as a multidimensional issue. As Ricky said, it's a labor issue. It's an educational issue. It has to do with housing. It has to do with people's experience with incarceration.
I come from a state, Nebraska, that is pro-life, but the budget isn't pro-life. The support services for food stamps and housing support is not pro-life. The number of young people Black and brown young people who are in foster care and group homes, and the way those kids are treated at 18 and 19 is not pro-life. And so for us to remove the autonomy of people who can introspectively say, this is not the right time for me, this is not something I'm prepared for, and all the other reasons someone can make that choice to say, well, children deserve to be here, we'll figure it out later. We've had centuries to figure it out, and we are still seeing young people go from the juvenile system to the adult system.
It has to do with so many different facets of our society that affect people's ability to access abortion, that affect people's need to access abortion, and that fundamentally affect how people think about abortion. And for me, it ended up aligning really closely with how we imagined the book, because going into it, we felt like this is something that needs to encompass as many of the dimensions of people's lives that are affected by abortion as possible. And I'm grateful that we had so many fantastic contributors that took time away from the work that they were doing to help us document for the record what was going on, especially because these kinds of things can oftentimes be lost to history. There's so many moving parts. And as a sociologist, that was really important to me. I wanted to make sure that these people's actions weren't lost to history and that people didn't know what they were doing.
In the sense that this is a record of the first year. This is a record of the first post-Dobbs year. I just want to underscore the fact that I think we invited maybe 54 people to join us, and 52 of them said yes, and the two who didn't couldn't. So I think that was very affirming that this was a good idea. It was something that people wanted to see out there as a resource. And in fact, today I gave a lecture at a college in Boston, and what the people wanted to hear was, what can they do? And I talked about the book, and I had it with me, and we all looked at it variously together. And I said, look, you can look at this landscape and find yourself a place in it. And I could talk to them about, for example, the abortion funds, these entities that collect money and make sure that people in Texas and in Mississippi, Alabama, know that there are these funds. Talk about it being hard to train people to think in terms of reproductive justice. I don't know if it is, but it's also very hard to get out the word about abortion funds. For example, we know that last year in Texas, there were something like 10,000 excess births that wouldn't have occurred before Dobbs. We also know, of course, that in Texas, people are desperately ill and forced to be desperately ill, and that the teen birth rate is going up in Texas. All things that women will be punished for. And also, as an aside, I just must say that in the many years I've been writing books about this, one thing I've learned for sure is that it is impossible for women or anyone who can become pregnant to be what you might call a full citizen, living with dignity and safety, if she can't control her own body. And we know a lot in this country, more than in most countries, about what happens when people can't own their own bodies, manage their own bodies, have dominion over their reproductive lives. We called that the slavery regime in the United States. It's just impossible for people to have equal status to others when they can't manage their own bodies.
Do you sometimes feel like we are in some kind of nightmare? Like this can't possibly be our reality? That's a serious question. When I had a daughter 9 years ago, I would have never thought that this would be a fight that I would have to fight for her. It doesn't feel real sometimes to me. And maybe it's just some kind of protection mechanism.
You know, we see this intersectionality here, and we see these different communities who are impacted by Dobbs in different ways. And so that sort of sets up, I think, a model for us to move forward in some ways as we're thinking about how coalition building happens, how organizing happens, and how we actually, and Alyssa and I talk about this a lot, about bringing organizing, the action, the impact, the movement closer to the people who are most deeply impacted, as opposed to people like me, who should be doing a lot more listening and a lot less talking. But I think one of your contributors in here, and I think this is one of those essays that is really important, but you talk about her in the introduction, and then she has her own essay a little bit later in the book, talking about the impact of Hyde on indigenous communities, of the Hyde Amendment, rather, in particular, in part in her essay. And I was ashamed in some part to think that I hadn't specifically considered how impacts of government funding might impact indigenous communities or other communities that were not like me. And I wonder if you might just talk through that a little bit, how this might impact indigenous communities a little bit differently than perhaps our listeners might expect it to be.
I so appreciate this question. And I think getting at your point, Alyssa, it does feel like a nightmare to me. It also reminds me, though, that the reproductive health and abortion landscape has been a nightmare for many people for a very long time.
For Native people, this has a wide range of impacts. And so today we really wanted to center Indian country and how Dobbs might be impacting us. I think many of us are aware that abortion care was already heavily restricted, either substantively or in practice for Native people. And unfortunately, as Native America is all too familiar, these types of restrictions tend to disproportionately impact Native people.
I think Koya's essay really helps us get at that fact that I think there's a point in the essay where she says that many Indigenous women experienced a higher degree of body sovereignty and freedom than the white women colonizers they encountered. And so it's this really important point about helping us contextualize people's experiences and helping us recognize the ways that while Dobbs today obviously is negatively affecting so many people, the ways that Indigenous women's reproductive autonomy, their practices around self-managing their pregnancies or their abortions, the ways that that knowledge was taken from many communities, that is a type of violence that is not talked about. That is not talked about, at least in when we think about mainstream people's experiences. It's not something that many people know about. And I think the work that Koya and other contributors are doing in this book is helping surface for people who are unaware the kinds of violent attacks on Indigenous communities, on communities of color, the attacks that have gone under the radar for many people, but have fundamentally shaped their experiences. Ricky's talking about the long history of slavery and how slavery has affected Black women's experiences with their fertility and their ability to create their families. And so there's so many ways in which the nightmare that we see unfolding today has been deepened by the Dobbs decisions. And I think the book also gives us reminders of the ways that for many people, this nightmare has been their waking reality for many years. And activists have demonstrated the importance of fighting for that. Even if there are people out there who don't know about it, there are communities that do, and they're fighting to make sure that people have access to the care, knowledge, networks, et cetera, that they deserve. And the contributors help us showcase that in the book. And I'm really grateful to them for helping us do that.
One of the things that I love about what Koya says in her piece is she says, with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we have an opportunity, actually, to be more radical, to be more inclusive, to be more creative about what is actually required, because Roe was never enough. And it's so uplifting to have someone associated with this book, everybody associated with this book is thinking beyond the bad dream. That's one of the things. And that's why I said, you know, I can slit my throat, which is the bad dream, or I can do something creative and collaborative, which will take us somewhere else. And I just love the way Koya captured beyond the bad dream.
I think that's why people want to hear, if you're at a speaking engagement, they want to know, what can we do? Because I feel like when you give people something to do, actionable items, steps for them to take, it does help overcome that sense of grief, of loss, of desperation, of depression, of all the things. We all need steps to take. And I do think that will be the legacy of the book beyond just the book, which is incredibly important, but how you can continue to speak on what people are doing, where they're doing, the stories you've heard. Here's how Koya is making a difference. Here's how this person's making a difference. Here's what you can do. And then it really becomes a really fabulous ripple effect.
I don't think anybody here is anywhere near old enough to really have lived through the time of the Whole Earth Catalog. This man named Stuart Brand put together this very famous catalog on newsprint, which had thousands of innovations and opportunities, and it was published several times in the 60s and maybe once in the early 70s. And it was just a cultural phenomenon for its time. And I think in some ways, our book is a whole activist catalog for what people are doing out there, and therefore what you can do too. Attach yourself to one of these. We're so used to in the United States of thinking that we have to act as individuals. We have to be creative on our own. And that's very daunting, especially when you're facing something that feels like a bad dream or like hell. And if there are all these people, 52 people out there, thinking defiantly, creatively, collaboratively about what can be done, surely most of our readers will be able to imagine themselves in league with some of these people.
On the steps of the Supreme Court today, abortion rights activists grab back the megaphone.
My body, my choice!
Women should have the right to do with their bodies what they want to do with their bodies.
Hundreds of protesters were joined by Democrats looking for votes in 2020.
We will not go back!
Demonstrations organized in cities nationwide, triggered after a wave of restrictive abortion laws passed in multiple states.
The second part of the book is called Never Ending Emergency. Let's discuss that a little bit.
Absolutely. I think this relates to so much of what we've been talking about. And I think for me, one of the important things about what our contributors are showing in the book is the fact that when the Dobbs decision came down, there have been conversations that people are having, like Lori Oakes talking about baby safe haven laws, right? There are these things that pop up and people talk about the ways that we can sidestep people's need for abortion as if they're viable solutions to eradicating abortion access. And they just aren't, obviously. And the never-ending emergency portion of the book reminds people that we have to challenge each other and those narratives to showcase that what is going on is an emergency, right? There's not a way to come up with alternatives to abortion to help people meet their reproductive goals because they need abortion. And so whether it's people talking about relinquishing their children, whether it's people talking about being able to help clinics that provide abortion do other things, right? Obviously, it's important that people have access to the other forms of reproductive care aside from abortion, but showcasing the fact that the abortion clinics that exist are doing crucial work and it can't be replaced by something else. We need them to do abortion care, and that has to be made urgently apparent for people, right? They need to see that this is an emergency that is not going to end unless people get access to abortion care and they have access to abortion care when they need it. And if they don't, we have to keep fighting for it.
As the book starts to wrap up, there's a whole section that is called Resisting Religious Tyranny. And man, this is something I think about a lot as we look at what's happening in the country right now, because while it very directly impacts the ability of women, people who can get pregnant, people who are on a gender spectrum outside of what we think of the two binary poles of it, or the religious tyranny thinks of as binary poles, and so many other groups of people, that the ripple of, I see this as almost a path towards establishing a de facto theocracy in the United States. And I worry a lot about the ripple effects of that, not just on the abortion issue, but on issues far and wide beyond that and entrenching power things. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
As soon as abortion became legal in 1973, and a few states started to do before, and the agitation that went along with it, brought religion into the public square in a way that it hadn't been before, made it a difficult political issue, a public issue. Women's sexual bodies and their pregnancies became visible, talked about issue in the public square, and very often in the context of religion. So we've been living through the sacralization of the public square over the issue of abortion for some time. And of course, a lot of the people who were associated with violence against abortion practitioners in the 90s were extreme evangelical groups like the Lambs of Christ and others who were making very specific religious-based arguments. As a Jewish person myself, I am extremely freaked out by the fact that the Christian right can exercise dominion over my religion's tolerance and actual support of abortion under many circumstances. And the respect that some of the largest denominations of Judaism give to women to manage their own reproductive bodies. So I do feel the incursion of this kind of fundamental Christianity into my own life. I know I'm not alone. And this section that you cited about religious tyranny has the voices of a number of people from different faiths which support abortion. And these people are all, like I am, just devastated by the broad swath that the Christian fundamentalists and anti-abortion proponents have carved out. Is that religious freedom supposed to be a basic tenet of this country? It truly isn't.
Finally, what gives you both hope?
For me, I would say one of the things that really came from this book is showcasing the resistance, the beauty, and the hope that fighting together provides. And that helps me get up every single day, even as I know that there are people that are struggling out there to get the abortion care that they need, and that's having devastating consequences for their lives. I also know that for every person that's struggling, there are people out there that are fighting for them, and Fighting Mad showcases those people and what they're doing. And that gives me endless hope, because I know that even as the courts and folks, they failed us with the Dobbs decision, they failed us with decisions before the Dobbs decision, I know that people that are fighting, activists that are fighting, folks in the community that are fighting, they're holding us up. They're holding me up. They're holding other people up, trying to get them the care that they deserve and trying to protect their rights. And that makes me feel incredibly hopeful, even as I know that we are in some really tough times.
And I simply second everything that Crystal just said. Plus, I have to add that working with Crystal gives me hope. Because we could do something so hard and have such a good time doing it and yield something that we truly believe is of use. So if we can do it, it can be done.
And we appreciate you both working so hard, Crystal and Ricky. You give us hope. Thank you for all you do and for being a part of the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Tell me how we're supposed to understand a country where women are increasingly dying from childbirth, but also being forced to carry pregnancies to term.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Among industrialized nations, the U.S. is the only one with the highest maternal mortality rates and the only one that has rising maternal mortality rates. It's also important to note in the latest report that Black women continue to have much higher and disproportionate rates of maternal mortality compared to other groups. And what I hear from my patients when they come see me is that they know that they can't be pregnant. They've had complications in pregnancy before, or perhaps this pregnancy is causing their health to deteriorate. People make informed decisions about if and when they can become pregnant, and abortion is central to that. So when we ban abortion, when we make it more difficult to access, especially in the South, where the majority of Black people live in this country, it is exactly a racist act in order to ban abortion and to deny people access to this care.
You know, it is a nightmare, and I cannot believe that we still have to have this conversation. I can't believe that my country,
the country that holds itself as the moral leader of an allegedly free world, is so intent on controlling more than half its population. Government is never bigger than when it is in our reproductive systems, and it has to stop. I firmly believe that in November, we are going to send a message that will shake the foundations of Washington, with women fully asserting our power as a voting bloc. But that's just the start, you see. I am so grateful for the visions laid out in Fighting Matt, and I promise you this, I will never stop fighting.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.